Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome. So this morning, I'm going to be talking about the verse of the robe, or the robe chant. And I'll let you know why I decided to do that. I actually had a couple reasons for wanting to talk about this short verse this morning. And the first is that I just finished this past Monday was our last class. I just finished helping Ted O'Toole, one of our senior teachers here, teach a class on Zen ritual and liturgy that went for 7 weeks. And we talked about we spent 7 weeks with 15 people. It was really wonderful, talking about the important function and meaning and value of ritual in our Zen tradition. And one of my jobs was to do a real quick overview on some of the meanings of the chants that we do in our liturgy here in our services. And one of those is the verse of the robe. And I really got into it when I started writing this. I was like, I got about 5 minutes to spend on the verse of the robe. And as I started writing it out, I realized there's 40 minutes worth of material here. So I went really fast for those folks. But it was very easy to expand. There's a lot of material. And I was surprised, I think, how much teaching there was in those lines for me, how much inspiration and support were in those lines for me. So I really enjoyed spending the time I did with it. So that's reason number one. And the second reason I wanted to talk about the robe chant is Stacy. Our Stacy. Because in 6 days, as some of you know, Stacy's going to receive her okesa, her robe, when she's ordained. She's being ordained here on Saturday. And the relationship between a monk and her robe is very intimate, as she already, I'm sure, knows very well. She has spent many months sewing on it. We sew our own robes in the Zen tradition. Sewing is actually a really important part of our tradition. And it takes a long time to sew a full robe. And if you ask Tomoe-san, Tomoe Katagiri is our founder's widow, and she still lives in the city here. She teaches sewing. It is our great good fortune to still be able to work with Tomoe-san. And I asked her once, so how long does it take to sew an okesa, a full robe? And she said, girl or boy? I said, well, I'm a boy, a year. Girl, 6 months. That's offensive and sexist, you guys. And the fact it's true makes it worse. So anyway, sewing is an important part of practice. And the sewing itself is done in a ritualized, meditative manner. We offer incense and we do 3 prostrations before we begin sewing and again at the end. And we sew by hand, of course, and we sew in silence. And there's a silent chant that goes with each stitch. I take refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Dharma. I take refuge in the Sangha. So the robe is a big deal, but because this was kind of at the front of my mind because of this class and because of Stacy, I thought I'd spend some more time with it today. And so to help kind of contextualize this, for those of you who are newer to Zen Center, we do a service here, a short service, 5 days a week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday morning, and Saturday morning. And the service is right after the sitting. The service is right after Zazen. So the very first thing we do after Zazen to start the service is we do this chant. We do this chant 3 different times. 1, 2, 3. Right in a row. We repeat it 3 different times. So for a lot of you, this is very familiar. But I thought it might be fun to chant it together. So some of you, of course, have this in your noodle. And some of you, hopefully, have it on a bulletin that is sitting in front of you. We'll just do it once. If you don't have a bulletin in front of you and you don't know it, just fake it. Or don't worry about it. But it's a beautiful teaching. I thought it might be nice to hear it together. So we'll do this. Does everybody have it? Okay, we will do it. It goes like this.
How great the robe of regarding ourselves in Buddha's teaching, freeing all beings.
Thank you. I should quit right now. So that's the chant. And so why do we do that? Why do we start our service that way? A few months ago, Shohaku Okumura is a name I know a lot of you know. He was our interim head teacher here for 3 years back in the early 90s. About 3 months ago, I want to say, 4 months ago maybe, a book of his came out called Living in Vow, Living by Vow, I think. And the entire book is the MZMC chant book. It's our chant book, broken down. He takes all the verses that we normally chant, and he talks about all of them. It's about a 200 or 300 page book, and it's actually a beautiful book. And he spends about 10 pages worth on the verse of the robe. And so I want to quote him here. His story, and this is the story that a lot of us are familiar with, about the origin of the robe chant. When Dogen Zenji went to China and began to practice at Tiantong Monastery in 1223, he found that the monks rested their folded ocases, that's the robe, atop their heads with veneration and chanted this verse after early morning zazen every day. And then he quotes Dogen. At that time, I felt I had never before seen such a gracious thing. My body was filled with delight, and tears of joy silently fell and moistened the lapel of my robe. The young Dogen vowed to transmit this practice to Japan, and as a result, for the past 800 years, in Dogen Zenji's lineage, we have chanted this verse every morning after zazen when we put on our okases or rakusus. So that's kind of the origin story of how in Soto Zen we adopted the robe chant about 800 years ago. And after morning meditation here, after morning zazen, everyone in the zendo chants this verse 3 times. And it's important that we chant it 3 times. That speaks to its importance to us. 3 times. We say that. There's so much there. 3 times we say it. And I think it's, and this didn't occur to me until I started writing this talk for the class, I think it's incredibly significant that everybody chants it, whether they wear a robe or not. Right? So if you have one of these, if you have a raksu, if you've gone through Zen initiation or something, you have a raksu. You get to put it on your head and you chant it. But even if it's your very first time at Zen Center, you've never been here before, and you may never come back again, you still get to chant this 3 times. So everybody is in. Does that make sense? There's not an exclusive club, in other words. You know, everybody gets to do this. And what that speaks to is that there is a literal robe, a tangible robe, the things that Stacy's been working on for months, the things that we work on. But there's also an intangible robe. And that is the robe I want to spend my time talking about. That's the robe that I think we choose to wear when we follow in our lives a path of awareness and compassion and loving kindness. That's what Zen practice, that's what Buddhist practice is about, you know, not about clothing. So there's an intangibility to that, and everybody's included. We all chant this together. So it's not exclusive, and we all start from the same place then, in that morning service. We all make those same vows. So what I want to do is just talk about the chant itself. I want to kind of break it down line by line and just give you my thoughts on it. So it starts with how great. And of course, in this case, great doesn't mean awesome. It's not a quality judgment. It's more of a kind of how great. How great. It's the sort of thing that we think or we say when we see a beautiful sunset or the Grand Canyon or that image of the Earth rising over the moon. That those the first people who went around the moon took that photo of the Earth rise, and we got to see ourselves for the first time. In that sense, it's that kind of how great. So it's pointing to something that is wordless, you know, can't actually be said, because it's awe. It is awe and wonder. How great is awe and wonder? And awe can't be said. Of course, it goes past our words. And if we are in a state of awe or wonder, we've already dropped all of our words and ideas. And I think that's because awe doesn't fit in our heads. It doesn't fit in our heads. You know, respect can sort of fit in your head, or, you know, some forms of kind of appreciation can fit in your head. But awe and wonder are really too big for our brains to wrap around, because they're experiences, right? Not concepts. That's an experience that you're having. Huangzi, who's one of my favorite Chinese, I almost said my favorite, one of my favorite, a really good Chinese Zen teacher, says, at the end of one of his first practice instructions, with thoughts clear, sitting silently, wander into the center of the circle of wonder. He's talking about meditation practice. He's talking about zazen there. Wander into the center of the circle of wonder. It's just really nice to hear wonder used in conjunction with meditation. I really like that a lot. So he's talking about the quality of mind that we cultivate, right, in our practice. Mindfulness, presence, availability to our experience leads to these moments of wonder and these moments of awe. And they're certainly not exclusive to the Grand Canyon or the sunset or the Earthrise. They are sometimes a glass of water or a wet bicycle chained to a post, or, you know, a full mailbox, whatever it is. When you don't have a preconceived idea, when you've let go of your agendas, when you're just available, everything is of equal luminosity. How about that? So there's an emotional dimension to awe. How great has an emotional dimension? And I think the emotion is gratitude. I think awe and wonder, I think the emotional dimension of that is gratitude. Uncultivated, it just arises right there. And we have to be open in order to experience wonder and awe. And that's not only an intellectual openness, open-minded, available to different ideas, but there's an emotional availability, a willingness to be receptive. And awe and wonder want to be shared because they're too big to be held. They're just too big. So wow, how great. That's where we start with this verse. The verse of the robe starts with that. Wow. That's my translation. Awe and gratitude. These are the foundations of awareness. They are the foundations of Zen practice. Awe and gratitude. And they're also the fruits of our practice as well. These arise with greater frequency in our lives when we devote ourselves to this practice. These moments of receptivity, intimacy, availability, wonder and awe. They are the path and they are the goal. So it's quite lovely in that way. So the robe of liberation. How great the robe of liberation. So liberation, of course, in this context is freedom from suffering. That's the point of Buddhist practice. That's kind of why we're all here. Some translations of this chant say virtuous field, which I like too. As you imagine, you know, these things weren't written in English, so there's a load of different translations out there, and they sometimes vary quite wildly, but I like virtuous field as well. I think I like robe of liberation because it reminds me that liberation is not distant. It is not far away. In fact, it's closer to me than my own breath. It reminds me that it isn't down the road when Martin is perfected. It isn't later when he finally gets his act together. It isn't even 3 seconds from now when the robe goes from the top of the head to around the body. It's much closer than that. Much more intimate, our liberation. Katagiri Roshi says, there is a path to freedom in every moment. I quote that a lot because that line knocks me out. There is a path to freedom in every moment. So that's how close it is. You know, never later. And it's so funny how we always think it's later. You know, I mean, I just perpetually think it's just around the corner. If I never later, always now. So that's how liberation is in Zen practice. That's how it's described. That's how it's taught to us. It's never other than this, and it's never, ever later. It can't be later. There's no later. It's this. It's now. And Dogen teaches us that practice and enlightenment are not two. Practice and enlightenment are one. And the world of samsara, the world of difficulty, is not separate from the world of ease and bliss, that those are one. We say that a lot here. That's one of our standard kind of Soto Zen drums that we beat. And I need to be reminded of that all the time because I continually separate them. I always think it's later. So in short, the robe of liberation is your life. It is your life. And it includes the long enlightenment pieces, and it includes the short delusion pieces. I heard that once. I don't know if that's true, that the long pieces on the robe symbolize awakening and the short pieces symbolize delusion. But they're all sewn together. We get the whole thing. We get all of it. So your life, this liberation, includes all those little things, those little stitches that turned out really well, that you really like, that worked perfectly. And it includes all the little stitches that just, you don't like them. It didn't work. It was a disaster. The Hindenburg stitches. Your life includes them. Your life includes them. And isn't it lovely, right, that the liberation that your life is, what your life actually is, includes those things. You know, I think that's quite beautiful. And, you know, this your life, it's easy to make that into an abstraction, to kind of step back and look at this whole thing. And it isn't an abstraction. Your life is not an abstraction. It is just this. Right now, this is the entirety of it. This is all of it right now. So this is the robe. This is your life. This is your chance. This is your chance for liberation, right? And the good news is it's infinite. It's always arising. Moment after moment. Chance after chance. Chance. Infinite chances. I think that's why awe and gratitude are such an appropriate response. When you realize, wow, the robe is my life and it's infinite. Gratitude immediately is there. How great the robe of liberation. A field is next. A field. So in this case, the word field refers to the literal Buddhist robes, rice field pattern, long rows and short rows to symbolize the rice fields of ancient India, which is how Buddhist robes have been made for about 2,500 years, according to the story. So it refers to that field, but it also refers to everything, to this. This life of ours, right as it is, in this moment, is the only place we can plant those seeds. Right? The seeds are something we have some control over. Am I planting seeds of awareness and kindness and compassion? Am I planting seeds of loving kindness and availability? Or am I planting seeds that are not quite as helpful? All of us do both, of course. But there's a moment of choice, and the moment is here. It's the only place we get to plant seeds in our lives is now. This is the field. This is the chance. This is the moment. So Shohaku, in the book, says, when we wear the okesa, we are farming. This is the meaning of field. This body and mind is the field we work. It is not a field of fortune from which we can expect to receive blessings without practice. We have to cultivate our life. Gee, that's really good. I love when we wear the ocasa, we are farming. I don't know, that's just really sweet to me for some reason. I think that's so sweet. I just imagine myself with a little hoe every time I'm... It's very, you know, tangible. I like that, planting seeds. But there it is. The life is the field. Your life is your field. Far beyond form and emptiness. So this is my favorite part. This is my favorite part of the Robe Gem. And I like it. What I actually realized when I was writing this was I like how it feels in my body and my emotions when I say it. Far beyond form and emptiness. I just love it. My brain cannot get there. I just love it. So I feel it in my chest. I like that line. And it reminds me, of course, of the Heart Sutra and all of its teachings for us on the equivalency of form and emptiness. You know, that sutra spends so much time saying that these two things are not two. So I like this field is far beyond form and emptiness. So don't get caught. It's not cloth. Don't get caught. It's not made of earth. Don't get caught. It's not literal. It's beyond form. It's also beyond emptiness. So you can't fit it in your noodle. Because when I first chanted, I thought, well, hold on. If it's not form, then it must be emptiness. But now you're telling me it's not emptiness either. So if it's not form and it's not emptiness, then what is it? Which is a pretty good question, right? This is the kind of questions we're encouraged to ask around this place.
Isn't that funny?
It's just not many places you go where you're encouraged to ask questions like that, so I think it's kind of cool. But the other thing it reminded me of immediately was there's that, for those of you who've been to Dharma Field, one of our kind of sister sanghas a couple miles from here, they have a lovely quote painted over their entrance from Rumi that's very well known. Out beyond our ideas of right and wrong, there is a field. I will meet you there. That reminds me very much of this. Out beyond our ideas of right and wrong, there is a field. I will meet you there. So there's your field, right? Beyond form and emptiness, beyond right and wrong. Rumi just has a way of sneaking in every time I sit here. I don't know what that is. I've got to do something. Prevent that from keep happening. So beyond form and emptiness, though, is really a powerful reminder, for me at least, of the true scale of our practice. That it is inconceivable. It is inconceivable. Dogen says he has a fascicle in the Shobo Genzo called Kesa Kuroku, I want to say, Kesa Kuroku, that the whole fascicle, 10 pages maybe, is on the robe. And one of the things he says in there is the robe exists beyond our ideas of it. The robe exists beyond our ideas of it. So I read this whole fascicle, I don't know, years ago, actually before I was ordained. And the whole thing, it's fabulous. It's full of all these magical things that the robe can do. It turns oxes into dragons, and right? Something like that. It's really, really cool. It does all sorts of fabulous stuff, you guys. But I walked away from this whole thing, this whole fascicle, being like, wow, he was really into this. But that was the line that stuck with me. It exists beyond your ideas of it. And I thought, wow. And then I realized that's not limited to the robe at all. My whole life exists beyond my ideas of it. This microphone exists beyond my ideas of it. Ben exists beyond my ideas of it. Wow, the scale of what's happening is infinite. And it really opens me up when I think of it that way. Far beyond all your ideas about your life, it exists. That's pretty cool. If you were to list every single thing about you, every single thing you remember, every little thing you want, every possible concept you've ever had about your life, it exists beyond all of those things. So you can't grasp it. And I realized that to actually say, I understand about anything, is actually a lie. Or I guess to put it more politely, it's sort of a relative or convenient truth. But if we just say, I understand, you know, fill in the blank there, right? Immediately, that's a lie. So when we leave a space, when we leave a space for this type of awareness, that's where the wonder enters, that's where the awe enters, beyond form and emptiness. The next line is, wrapping ourselves in Buddha's teaching. Wrapping ourselves in Buddha's teaching. Gee, that's a good one. And that's the real, that's another way of understanding the robe. That's another way of understanding the metaphor of the robe, is that the robe is the teaching. You know, Buddhism and Zen especially is a lived, practiced way of life type religion. It's not a conceptual thing. It's not a belief system thing. The idea for these teachings isn't to put them in your noodle and believe in them. The idea is to try them, put them into practice, experiment. It's almost like the scientific model. Like, this guy had this idea that this might be the cause of suffering. Why don't you try that out and see how it works for you? There really is that kind of implicit understanding that you're not accepting any of this stuff on faith. You're going with it for a while. You are the laboratory, right? You are the one performing the experiment. You're going to try it and see if it's working for you. I find that reassuring because the blind faith thing makes me a little nervous, frankly. I also find it reassuring because that also implies that for 2,500 years, people have been trying the same formula and going, yeah, he's right. So it's like, wow, there's lots of people who have found this to be true. Hopefully they've worked out most of the bugs, I guess is my thought. But that's the teaching, and the teaching is for you. Right? The teaching is for you. And you wrap yourself in it, wrapping ourselves in the teaching. I like the intimacy of that a lot. The robe is the practice. The robe is the way. The robe is the teaching. That is our protection from and our response to suffering. You know, that's what Buddhism is about, as I mentioned. Suffering. How do we transform suffering into joy? It is our response to suffering is the practice, the teaching. It is our protection from those things. And I like the body element. I mean, I like the fact that the word wrapping is a very physical word, wrapping ourselves. That puts a nice image in my head. That feels different than memorizing Buddha's teaching. Generally getting the gist of Buddha's teaching. It doesn't feel the same to me as wrapping ourselves in it. You know, when you're cold and you reach for a blanket, you don't have to understand the blanket. Right? You just wrap yourself in it. It's being stored in your body, in your soul, in your mind, in your heart. You wrap yourself up in it. That line has a grandmotherly quality to it, to me. And that's reassuring. I am a pretty cerebral person, and I think a lot of us have been kind of pretty trained to be pretty idea-focused and pretty mentally focused, which is fine. It has its place, of course. But I like to remind myself that we don't have to be clever to do this practice. You don't have to have some sort of great memory, or you don't have to have a great understanding of Buddhist history or sutras or any kind of complex Buddhist cosmology or any of that kind of stuff. You do not have to be well-schooled to do this. It is very basic. It is very simple. It actually is. It's as simple as wrapping up in a blanket when you're cold. That's how simple it is. Yeah, you don't have to know anything to do that. You just do it. In fact, you know, you do it before you think about it. Cold, blanket. You don't think about it. I am cold. I will therefore find something that will help me stay warm. I will find a blanket. No, you just do it. And in the Buddhist view, you know, human life is abound with experiences like being cold. Suffering is universal. We all have these things. We all have these experiences. We all have these experiences of difficulty and struggle. And so we reach for these practices. We reach for these teachings. We reach for this way. to help us work with those things, to help us live through those things. And, you know, after doing practice for a while, meditation practice for a while, Zen practice for a while, you really don't think about it anymore. You know, even if the teachings go through the door of your brain, that's fine. But after a while, they get stored someplace else. And they just become your go-to thing. You know, your go-to thing. Awareness becomes kind of your default setting, as opposed to the strange, weird thing you're practicing for 20 minutes a day until the timer goes off. It's more of, oh yeah, this is just how I am in the world. A little more available, a little more open, a little more soft. So I think the blanket is always right there. We just get better at remembering to reach for it, right? We just get better at doing that. So wrapping ourselves is a wonderful line. I also like the portability. That's a funny word. I like the portability of this line because I always used to imagine myself when I still do go to morning service as often as I can, but when I was a morning doan, I was here every week helping with the service and so chanting it every day. And then we're done and we leave the Zen Center. So I'm leaving, you know, at 7:30 in the morning or whatever, and the sun's coming up and I'm entering my day. And I used to kind of imagine myself, oh, I'm still wearing them. It was actually easier for me to imagine this during the winter when I was cold. I don't know why. During the summer, you don't want anything wrapped around you, but that's an aside. But I remember, oh, it's wrapped around me. It's wrapped around me. It helps. It helps support me. It helps protect me. And, of course, that is the point of Zen practice, is to take that out, right? Take it out into the world. The teaching isn't about this room or this building. We practice here together. We get support we need here together. But the point is to take it out. It is portable. That's the whole point. We take it out. You wrap yourself in it. You take it out into the suffering world, right? That's the whole point. So even though that morning service only takes about 10 or 15 minutes, it really is a fabulous way to start your day. I highly recommend it for those of you who are liturgically oriented. Alrighty, so the last line is freeing all beings. Freeing all beings. Well, in Mahayana Buddhism, which certainly includes Zen, the fundamental purpose of our practice, as I mentioned, is to relieve suffering, but the line, there is no line drawn between self and other. To relieve suffering is to relieve suffering. Your suffering and my suffering are not two. So the fundamental purpose of practice is to remind ourselves over and over, freeing all beings, freeing all beings. That's why I'm here doing this. And so I'll quote Shohaku one more time from his book. Since we are not substantial, we cannot live alone without being supported by other beings. We have to live together with others. This is another essential point of the Buddha's teaching. We cannot be completely peaceful unless all living beings are in peace. We cannot be completely happy if we are aware of someone who is unhappy. When we awaken to this reality, the bodhisattva vows arise naturally. The vow to free all beings is not a duty or promise to the Buddha. The vow does not mean that we are great people and we have to save all others like millionaires who give money to the poor. When we open our eyes to the reality of our lives, we simply cannot help but share happiness and sadness, pleasure and pain with all beings. To be peaceful, we have to do something for other beings. We live within the Buddha's vow to save all beings. Those are beautiful words. And a reminder here that we live within the Buddha's vow to save all beings, that the Buddha is you. The Buddha is all of us. It's not someone else's you're borrowing. It's yours. It's yours. And the vow to save all beings is a whole other talk in and of itself. But I do love that when we say the bodhisattva vows, which we will at the end of our time here together, they're the four vows that are printed at the bottom of your program. I love that the relationship in Buddhism to suffering is to turn toward it. I think that's beautiful. It's kind of counterintuitive, at least it was to me at first, but that seems beautiful. And that the second thing is that to recognize that it is infinite and therefore impossible to fix, and my response is to vow to fix it. That seems... I'm not even sure how that seems. All I know is it feels really profoundly right to me, that I can't really explain that. That the fact it's impossible has nothing to do with your vowing to do it. That it's what a human heart does when it is exposed to suffering. I vow to free this. I vow to untie this knot. That's what I will do. The fact it can or can't be done is completely beside the point. So that's quite lovely. Freeing all beings. So as I mentioned, the ideals of Mahayana Buddhism, which, as I said, includes Zen Buddhism, are the Bodhisattva ideals, compassion and service. We could say it that way. Compassion and service. The emphasis is on compassion and not dispassion. And the emphasis is less about individual attainment and more upon service and helping. Being an enlightening being as opposed to an enlightened. Does that make sense? And of course those distinctions don't exist in any real way, but it's just the language we use around them. So this is the end of our robe chant, freeing all beings, reminding us of our vows, reminding us of the path, the purpose of the path of freedom for others and for us. Hongzhe again says that I'm thinking of freeing all beings again in terms of the field of our lives is where we do this liberating, where we do this freeing. And Hongzhe describes in the very beginning of his practice instruction, he says, the bright, boundless field exists from the very beginning. This predates us. And it's a way of him saying, kind of what Dogen says, that the way is originally perfect and all-pervading. I mention this because we hold a lovely paradox in Zen, that there is an infinite amount to be done, and we have to do it, and that there is nothing to be done, and we don't need to do anything. And these are simultaneously true. You know, one doesn't exclude the other. And it's interesting to work with that in your life, to see, to actually experience both those as being very, very deeply true. Perfect, right as it is right now. So much to be done. So kind of Suzuki's quote, what was his, you're all perfect as you are and you could all use a little improvement. Yeah, that's it. That's a much more normal way of saying bright, boundless field that exists from the very beginning. So the verse of the robe ends with our statement of purpose as Zen students, to free all beings, to be helpful. And remember... please remember that you're a being, too. All beings includes you. It's easy for us, maybe I'm speaking of myself, it's easy for me to think that free all beings means, oh man, I better start a list because there's a bunch of them out there. And my name is never on the list. It's you guys. I've got to be worried about all you guys, right? My name is on there. My name is on there. Your name is on there. Remember to include yourself. Don't leave yourself out. And remind yourself, perhaps, if it's supportive to you, that when you sit meditation, when you do zazen, you help. You help. When you sit, you make a difference. And never mind understanding that. Don't worry about it. Really, don't worry about it. Just do it. I think if you continue to do the practice, you see that for yourself, how that matters, how that makes a difference. Don't worry about explaining it. You actually experience how that matters. you will notice how much more susceptible to awe and wonder you become. How much more susceptible, vulnerable even to your experience you become. How much more open you become. Your mind stills after a while. Your heart opens after a while. Even if it's little tiny bits from here to bit, bit, here to there, now and again, little bits, more available, more present. There it is. You become more prone, I think, to gratitude, to just being there with it and just being, wow, here it is. Full and complete and whole, and there's suffering right there in the middle of it, and I'm grateful for all of it. It's fine. It's deeply fine. Right as you're working to improve it, it's fine. That actually experientially happens to us when we do this. You know. And you start to wear it. You start to wear that robe of liberation out into your life. You don't even have to think about it. You carry it with you. You carry it with you out into the suffering world. And I love that you don't have to try. It just happens. So don't worry about trying. And also don't get freaked out by how lofty all beings sounds. That sounds pretty lofty. That's pretty big. Don't get freaked out by that. All beings is just you. That's you. Whatever you're doing right now in your life, just give yourself to it. You are that. Cultivate the grateful heart. And that saving just happens all by itself. All by itself it happens. So, thank you very much for listening. I am done with my thoughts on the robe. I'm never done. But we do have a few minutes. If anybody would like to offer something, an insight or a question or a comment or a complaint, Stephanie.
Hardly a complaint. I thought it was a fantastic speech. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you were able to evoke all kinds of imagery. And so from that, there's a question, and I hope it's not boring to all the others, but it's quite a task for our whole body and mind to actually reconcile all these vexing differences. I had one image of a postcard. You know, maybe you know these where you change them and then the person on the card moves, or like they have that for the Pope, you know, whether it's the Pope and then the Pope blinks, you know. So it's like these two things, right? They're one, but they're not one in any given moment. Mm-hmm. But then over time, we also kind of have to keep track of time because we live in time and we change in time. So with these two different realities over time, that's a lot to process and we can't do it rationally.
Mm-hmm.
But, so then here comes my question. And I'm a little out of breath because it's taken my whole body to even ask the question. I'm working overtime. Then what is memory? What's the role of memory in practicing as a Buddhist? And is there maybe a body memory that helps us in this process of change and we cannot even access it? And is there maybe a mental memory, and is that important?
Mm-hmm.
Does that question make sense?
It does. That's a beautiful question. That's a beautiful question. Yes. I will. So correct me if I'm paraphrasing incorrectly. What is the role of memory in Buddhist practice, both mental memory and body memory? Does it have a? Is that right? What is the role of that? Yeah. Oh, I see. And actually, now that I'm saying that, I'm realizing your starting point is kind of the paradox of being in time, linear, cause and effect, and being at the same time outside of time. Only this.
Two paradoxes. The moment paradox,
and then
exponentially over time, living in this paradox every moment, but every moment is also different.
Yeah. Well, there's a very simple... answer to that question that luckily I don't know. No, that's a wonderful question. And I'm joking because it's a very complicated answer that I don't know. I will say this, though. I will say this, because that is something that I've spent some time on. I think this is one of those lovely things that if I were... Actually, I'll answer it two ways. The first is the quick and easy one, which is, yes, memory has a lot to offer us, very much, yeah. Living in the moment, you know, contains the past and the future. It doesn't ever exclude them. So, of course, we learn. Our experience teaches us a lot of stuff. We don't want to keep touching the stove each time because we've forgotten that it's hot. I mean, that's extremely important, and especially about the body stuff. Because a lot of us, especially when we come to meditation practice for the first time and we sit still for a while, after a while, stuff starts coming up. Isn't that interesting? Stuff that's been stored in your body. Unresolved grief, unresolved anger issues, unmet needs. I mean, they're stored in our cells. That's true. They come up. We sit with them. We work through them, right? So there's something there. That is a huge place for us, a huge teaching for us. The easy answer is it's our attachment to past or future that causes us these difficulties, so we remember to come back to things as they are, you know. But the second answer I'll give you is, a borrowed answer. This is a borrowed answer from Tim. This was not exactly the same question I brought to him, but one year during Rahatsu Sesshin, I brought him a question that was that big. Those real big questions, right? I'm sure teachers are thrilled to get, I don't know. Are you teachers thrilled to get questions like that? And he said... good answer. And I had this question from, what do I do with this? He said, that's a good question. Why don't you store that in your body? Don't think about it too much. I mean, thinking about it's fine, but just put it in your body. Let your body work on it. You know, if it's still bugging you, come back to me, but just store it. And I think what he was trying to tell me there, that was actually really helpful for me. I don't know if that's helpful for you, but you don't want to kill the question by answering it. You know, and I can't actually answer that for you. I have an idea for me. Oh, good, okay. So, yeah, just... There it is, folks.
That question. Just think on it. Just go with it. We don't know.
When I do something right accidentally, I am really happy about it. I gotta tell you that. Anything else this morning? Anybody else have any?
This is perhaps a little bit more practical, but your comment about comparing it to farming, quaint isn't the word I would have used, having grown up on a farm. I would say that if your intention is right, pure would be a good word, because you're dealing with it all very practically. You're looking at the field and watching the good things grow and the weeds grow, and you have to learn to separate them and be purposeful about what you're planting and all of the care and maintenance, and it's never ending. But it is so intentional, and if you view it in a helpful light rather than just this is never going to end and I hate it, I think pure and very practical would be words that I would choose to use rather than quaint.
So the metaphor works.
Yeah.
I wish I had invented that. I think you're right. I think I like it because it does sort of suggest that this is infinite, which hopefully helps us to detach from the idea of accomplishing and being done. Mm-hmm. What it hopefully doesn't bring up is the sort of despair of, I will never be done, which comes from the, I hate this kind of place.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish Ted were here, because he's upstairs teaching intro right now. But he's one of those people around this place who actually really loves weeding. If you're running a retreat and you're the work leader, give this guy weeding. He's so happy. He goes out there and he just weeds. And he weeds, and he weeds, and he weeds. Unless you go out and ring the bell like right next to his head, say it's time to come back in and be done, he will be out there weeding. No idea of ever finishing, because of course you can't, but that's really what he loves. There's something very concrete about that, right? Very practical, very immediate about that, yeah. It's a wonderful metaphor. We are farming. Kathy?
Was it Tim who said about the big vows, like freeing all beings? I remember hearing
they're not impossible, just inconceivable.
Yes. Yes, thank you. That was Tim. I'm fond of quoting that. That's what he told our initiation group years ago. I think it was probably me. This sounds like one of those troublemaking questions I would have asked. Why are we vowing to do something that's impossible? He said, they are not impossible. That's a pretty good question. I still think it's a good question, doggone it. And that was his response. Yeah, they are not impossible. They are just inconceivable. Pretty good answer. So, one more, and then we got to do announcements.
So prior to feeling really descriptive about the third line, wrapping ourselves in Buddhist teaching, even before we got to that moment talking about it, I just felt really warm, like a blanket.
Mm.
And just being like, it's cold outside, and I'm like, wow, I'm really comforted just sitting here. Mm. And not needing to, you know, not reaching out for like a blanket, but just feeling really safe. Mm. So when you talked about that, like, we have by far different experience, like neurogaming, for example. I'm kind of newer to Zen, but just to come across the same analogy, like, blew my mind. I'm like, yeah, I've been coming here, and I keep coming back because I get more open-hearted. And like when you were talking about those aha moments, like the other day I was working on like really extensive lab work, and it's something that's really tedious and not fun, and I started and I went on for like, what was it, like 16 hours? Like, I literally was just writing, and I look up at the time, and I'm like, oh, just an hour more. I'll just do an hour more. And it, like, blew my mind. Like, I just stayed up so late. Look at how much stuff I got done. And I enjoyed it. And so, I mean, there's a lot going on in that picture, but yeah, I just want to keep coming back. And then it's warm and comforting. And it feels
wonderful.
Like a home away from home.
Oh, I'm glad. Oh, I like that image, too. Yeah, that's nice, isn't
it?
Yeah. Yeah, I like what you're saying there. I love when the metaphor or the image or the is very simple. Something everybody gets. It's blanket, you know, robe. Something that keeps you warm. Something that's very, very simple. I think I do tend to make things too complicated, so I appreciate when I'm reminded of how simple it is.